Am I pronouncing that correct? Reedbelt, all right.
Thank you.
May it please the court. This court should vacate the district court's judgment and order awarding plaintiff attorney's fees in the amount of $17,250 for the following three reasons. First, the plaintiff should not be awarded attorney's fees as a prevailing party under Section 1988 in a case in which there's been no judgment on the merits, no court-ordered consent decree, no findings of fact or conclusions of law, and not even a settlement agreement defining the rights of the parties. Secondly, the state should have been dismissed from this lawsuit based on its assertion of 11th Amendment immunity. And third, due process and fairness concerns mandate that at the very least Judge Underwood should have been given an opportunity to answer and be heard before a judgment was issued against him.
You are representing all, aren't you, including Judge Underwood? You are representing Judge Underwood. Okay.
The question of attorney's fees in this case has been answered by the Supreme Court in Buckhannon, which has already been discussed today. In that case, the Supreme Court rejected the catalyst theory and held that a party must obtain an enforceable judgment or a court-ordered consent decree in order to qualify as a prevailing party for the purposes of attorney's fees.
Well, let me ask you about the order that Judge Kent entered. And it talks about the reason that he is granting the fees. And the letter that was sent, I mean, he granted and talked about why he thought that the fees were justified. The letter that was sent said that it was written or being sent because of this lawsuit. And so that was the relief that was granted, gained because of this lawsuit. The court, you know the language better than I do, said that the proceedings in this case and defendant's own filings indicate there's no formal consent decree. Defendant's actions, that letter, and resolution of the dispute were a direct result. I mean, this is different. But it is more than losing in the lawsuit, and there is a decree recognizing what's happened. I mean, we're making a little bit of new ground here. Why should we accept your view of this?
Well, I think under Buckhannon and its progeny, that the mere fact that the lawsuit was filed and eventually led to the resolution of the dispute is not good enough. It just does not chin the bar, no matter how we cut it. And I think in it, you know, under Buckhannon, you have to have either a judgment or a court-ordered consent decree. Now, in reality, I think it fails for two reasons. In reality, it's kind of a circular argument because they filed this lawsuit seeking to declare a non-existent state policy unconstitutional. And when Judge Underwood affirmed that this was a non-existent, the plaintiff claimed that she had won. In fact, I think under Buckhannon, while this was not raised by the plaintiff, the only way the letter and this advisory to the court arguably could support an award of attorney's fees is if the trial court found that the letter was part of a settlement agreement and that settlement agreement involved such a substantial degree of judicial approval and oversight that it amounted to a court-ordered consent decree. Now, the Fifth Circuit has not expressly addressed this issue. However, some other of our sister courts have occasionally found settlement agreements to be sufficient to confer prevailing party status, but only when the settlement changes the legal relationship of the parties and provides the level of judicial oversight and approval that makes it equivalent to a court-ordered consent decree. Now, that's not the case here, because I think even under a broad reading of the Buckhannon decision, the letter and the order dismissing the case do not provide the necessary judicial imprimatur. First, even assuming that she had raised this issue, the plaintiff had raised this issue, the letter does not bear any of the marks of a consent decree, does not name the parties or the lawsuit, does not bear the trial court judge's signature, does not oversee, the trial court judge did not oversee or approve any of the language or terms of the letter resolution of this lawsuit. And the trial court has not retained continuing jurisdiction to enforce the terms of this letter. It's unclear whether or not this letter was even a settlement agreement. I think we can all generally agree that this is not conventionally what we would refer to as a settlement agreement. I mean, it doesn't identify the parties, doesn't identify the lawsuit. it can't be enforced against one or the other. It's merely a letter from a judge over an administrative region to all the other judges in the region, reminding them to be mindful of the rights of those and privileges of those that come before him in his courtroom.
Well, it seems to be referred to in the letter itself as something that would be at least usable for 1983 purposes. When it talks about as a policy, practice, and custom, I mean, isn't this enforceable as a standard in various ways, as an announcement of the policy of this particular, whatever jurisdiction that would be, that administrative district?
Again, I think it's important to understand, again, I hate to go back to this, but the circular nature of this argument. It's that the state has never had a policy restricting the wearing of religious headwear in the courtroom.
That's talking about a different issue, it seems to me. I'm just asking, is this an enforceable policy, not whether they have gained
the
anything
letter,
through their own
Judge
efforts.
Is
a letter an enforceable policy, at least through if someone says their rights were violated, this is the policy, and it's been violated by whatever's happened to an individual? That's the part I'm looking at. Why would this not be enforceable in that way?
Who would enforce that letter? The letter itself is a letter from the judge to the other judges in his administrative region. It doesn't identify the parties to the lawsuit. It's not. It doesn't identify any of the claims mentioned, and it really, again, just affirms what the defendants already knew, which is that there has never been any policy restricting the wearing of headwear in the courtroom for religious purposes, and reminding judges in the administrative region to be mindful of that and to be respectful of the rights and privileges of all that come before them.
Would your position be the same if the letter would have stated that the policy requiring all persons not to remove headgear is rescinded, and then it was dismissed? There's no order, but as a result of the the admission that was, and then the rescinding, and that's the reason it's dismissed, then you could then go to the issue of whether this was a unconstitutional policy, and whether because of the actions of the state, the plaintiff prevailed because that unconstitutional policy has been rescinded. But as I understand it, there was no objection to this being settled this way. There was no contention, well, this is not enough. There has been a violation. There was a policy. Mm-hmm. It was just kind of an agreement to dismiss on the basis that this policy doesn't exist.
You're correct, Your Honor, and I think you're getting at the heart of what the Buchanan decision stands for, too, and that's that not only that it has to involve that judicial approval and oversight, but very importantly, it also has to come about as a change or modification in the legal relationship of the parties, and that has to be sanctioned by the court. Now, in this case, it just doesn't do that. What we have here, the letter in the advisory court, does not meet that standard, because the letter does not change the legal relationship of the parties. Besides the award of attorney's fees here, the plaintiff did not obtain any of the judicial relief that it was requesting as a result of her initiation of the proceedings against the state. The trial court did not make a declaration on the merits as to whether there was any such state policy or whether it had violated the plaintiff's right.
Well, I'm kind of interested in, I mean, this whole notion of the state policy. I mean, the underlying case was a particular judge, and we'll, for the moment, assume it's true that judge made Ms. Boyd remove her head covering or suffer failing to come into court. Okay, so we'll assume that argument, although I understand that to be disputed.
Well, I thought that case was dismissed.
If that
case was dismissed against the original judge, or is that still
correct?
And I'm sorry, I'm just making a hypothetical. Okay. I apologize. If that judge, Judge Henderson, in fact said, I have a policy that no matter what your reason, you can't have head covering, but no one else in the state, no region, the Texas Supreme Court, the other courts in that county. No one else had that policy. Then, in that situation, would the state be liable? I mean, not the state as under the 11th Amendment, but would there be liability on a state actor?
Well, I think very, very clearly there would, because in
on her.
Yes, I mean,
but it would only be her policy, and you could only sue her and not Judge Underwood or any other judge if it was just her policy in her courtroom.
I would think that would be correct. I think under 1983, you would sue the state.
And you would argue the state would still be immune under the 11th Amendment.
We would.
Okay. Here, however, as Judge Benavides pointed out, she's dismissed, and Judge Underwood says, we in this region do not have this policy.
Precisely, okay. Precisely. And so, again, the letter itself, if you look at the letter, which is included in our excerpts, in the appellate record, the letter itself affirms the non-existence of this state policy. There, under no interpretation of that letter could it constitute some sort of change or material alteration in the legal relationship between these parties that was court-sanctioned. And again, I think we need to go back to, just because it is such an unusual scenario where the court made a recommendation in open court under a docket call, that the mere fact that the court suggested a means to resolve the case, and the mere fact that the court encouraged the parties to try to resolve the case before a trial is not good enough. The Seventh Circuit in LaGrange has held that the trial court's mere involvement in settlement negotiations, even when the judge made certain settlement suggestions, was not good enough. And there's an additional court case in the Tenth Circuit entitled Bell that's briefed as well. In Hewitt, the United States Supreme Court held that there must be some grant of relief on the merits, not merely a favorable statement of law. And in that case, the Court of Appeals had even made a statement of law that there was a violation of constitutional rights in their opinion, but had not granted relief. And that was held not good enough for prevailing party status under 1988. In this case, when you boil it down, the plaintiff has no decision on the merits, no enforceable judgment on its constitutional challenge, no consent decree or functional equivalent of a consent decree, and absolutely no change in the status quo. This simply is not good enough. In the second issue, the state of Texas as defendant should have been dismissed from this suit based on 11th Amendment immunity. The plaintiff sued both the state of Texas and at various times, as we've already recognized, Judge Dorothy Henderson and Judge Olin Underwood for allegedly violating her constitutional rights. The state has consistently raised its immunity to suit solely on behalf of the state of Texas. The 11th Amendment jurisdictionally bars a suit in federal court by a private individual against an unconsenting state, regardless of the relief sought by the plaintiff. Now, the state did not consent to the suit, and the plaintiff has not alleged any facts that support a waiver of the defendant's immunity. The defendant's merely filing an advisory did not make such a clear declaration of waiver. The Supreme Court has held, again, that this waiver, this consent to suit, must be unequivocally expressed, with all ambiguities strictly construed in favor of the sovereign. This court, in fact, in the Fifth Circuit, has held that the state cannot waive immunity merely by entering into a consent decree or a settlement agreement, neither of which arguably are present here. In Sahir versus Estelle, this court examined a similar issue and held that standing alone, the fact that the sovereign entered into a settlement agreement or consent decree was not good enough to waive its 11th Amendment immunity. In that case, just as in this case, the court specifically noted that the settlement agreement did not expressly mention the state's sovereign immunity and certainly did not express any waiver of that sovereign immunity. By comparison, again, in Watson v. Texas, the Fifth Circuit correctly found that the state had waived its 11th Amendment immunity in a settlement agreement when the settlement agreement contained the following terms, quote, the parties acknowledge that this court has jurisdiction, unquote. And also, the settlement agreement in that case contained an enforcement clause that stated that the parties would bring any dispute under the agreement to the court. This, the advisory, the letter, none of which involves any language that would indicate that there was any clear declaration of waiver or consent to this lawsuit. And I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
If it may please this honorable court, my name is Anthony Griffin from Galveston, Texas. I have the pleasure of representing Kawana Board, who, as a citizen of the state of Texas, visited the Galveston County Courthouse for an administrative hearing surrounding child custody. When she appeared at the court, she was immediately told by the bailiff that she could not enter the court with her head covering, and she was asked to remove it. She informed the bailiff that she was Muslim and that her faith, because of her religion, she requested that she not remove her head covering. That dispute went on, and ultimately she was told by the judge that she didn't care what her faith was in the courtroom and told that she had to exit the courthouse. In the hearing before Judge Kent, one of the things that happened in that hearing, there was a discussion that took place at the bench. And counsel for the defendant said that we have no such policy. And I asked the court to speak and brought to the court's attention the contemporaneous evidence in the Galveston News. The judge was quoted as saying, and this is Judge Henderson, yes, I kicked her out. Yes, she was wearing a headscarf. It was not religious wear. And so we haven't taken the judge's deposition, but clearly some evidence exists out there that this judge recognized and tried to justify it by saying that it was his headscarf and took the position it was not religious wear and she did not care. And then the court stopped and said, wait, stop. This seems rather simplistic. Why can't we get this resolved? What does your client want? And my response was, my client wants an acknowledgement of her constitutional right, that she has a right to go in an open court with religious headwear and not be kicked out of the courtroom from it. And if that comes by way of letter, you know, so be it. But we want that to occur. The court has before it in this record the letters that went back and forth. I had sent a letter to counsel for the state saying, this is my recommendation of a letter, and it shows up under our tab E to our appendix, where we sent a proposed letter to the state. They then sent back a letter and asked me whether it met with my conditions, and I said, sure it does, but the only issue remaining in this case will be attorney's fees and the issue of cost. At that point, I then asked them, do you have a problem with filing a motion to administratively reopen this case to bring to the court's attention on attorney's fees? There was no objection. As well as there was no request by the state to consider their 11th Amendment argument and dismiss the state from the lawsuit. And the only reason that Judge Underwood wasn't sued individually in this case, the only reason he was brought into the lawsuit in the first place is the state objected because we sued Judge Henderson and he said the proper party to sue would be someone representing the Second Circuit, Judicial Circuit for the court. Now, the Supreme Court said in Buchanan, and Justice Rehnquist there's language that the court said, we have subsequently characterized the mere opinion as also allowing the award of attorney's fees for private settlements. And the question that the court dealt with, if someone voluntarily agreed to resolve the dispute, can you award attorney's fees? And the court did come back and pull back the whole issue of catalyst. And I recognize that. But then the court said, private settlements do not entail the judicial approval and oversight involving consent decrees, and federal jurisdiction to enforce a private contractual settlement would often be lacking unless the terms of the agreement are incorporated in the order of dismissal. And that's just exactly what Judge Kent did. Because when he then was asked to reinstate the matter, he entered his order where he set out quite clearly that after the, he said, order denying, ma'am, I apologize. order granting plaintiff's motion to reopen and granting plaintiff's motion for attorney's fees. It shows up under our appendix tab D. On page one of the order, he goes through the facts of the case and said plaintiff's conceded that this simple remedy would allay her concerns and would end this dispute. She sought no damages, but rather only proper acknowledgement of her First Amendment religious prerogatives. However, the state avoided the issue on a prompt, practical, amicable resolution and set out a year-long journey apparently calculated to delay, obfuscate, and evade the claims asserted against it. So early on in the Rule 16 conference, when dates are being set, the judge raises a concern that says, wait, stop for a minute. What are we litigating? If this happened, isn't there an easy way of resolving this dispute? When we came back to the court, the same issue came up. What is this issue? And the court did what trial judges are encouraged to do by this circuit. Push the parties, make the parties think about the issues, and try to get these cases resolved. And he did push the parties. And he turned in that conference and he turned to counsel for the plaintiff and said, what do you want? And the response was quite simple. All this client wants is to acknowledge her right to walk in our courtrooms with a head covering on if it's religious wear and not be kicked out of the courtroom and treated the same as everyone else. The letter then gets written to all the administrative judges in the Second Judicial District for the state of Texas, and the letter essentially satisfied my client, acknowledging her religious rights. At that point, it met the four corners of Justice Rehnquist's opinion, where he said, unless the terms of the agreement incorporated in the order of dismissal. Judge Kent does something else also in his order. He then begins to track how the litigation unfolded in terms of the motions being filed. And he says Chief Judge Underwood, to all judges to the Second Administrative District, reminded them of the rights of the citizens to wear their religious headdressing. The parties' relationship had changed. And there was a settlement. It would not have occurred unless my client was upset with what occurred in the trial court level and walked in and said, I just simply want them to understand I too have a right to be in a courtroom if I wear religious wear.
Mr. Griffin, let me take that language you just read and make sure I understand the significance that you're giving to it. Judge Kent, in his order, said that all judges in this district were reminded of the rights of citizens to wear religious headgear. And then he talks about the three factors for prevailing party. Materially altering the legal relationship between the parties is one, obtaining actual relief is another, modifies defendant's behavior is the third. What are you saying this reminder, if we accept Judge Kent's characterization of the letter, are you saying it satisfies all three? Actual relief, materially alters, modifies behavior? A reminder, you know, do the right thing out there on First Amendment rights? Is it doing any of that?
I think it does all of that.
And because, would you walk me through that? Because it's...
Because we have a client who feels aggrieved and has been, and assuming the facts the way play it for a minute, a client who feels aggrieved and was excluded from a public courtroom. And she says, I want to at least affirm that if I have to go back to this court, I don't get kicked out again. She then narrowed her relief and said, I'm not going to make a mountain out of a molehill and walk into any courtroom and say, I want X hundred thousands of dollars for the insult that I've incurred. I think I have a First Amendment right to be in the courtroom. I just want that affirmed. All a letter would suffice. Please remind the courts and the judges sitting in these administrative law judges that I have a right to be in the courtroom with my hijab, that I have a right to be in this courtroom. Once that letter was written, it materially altered the relationship because Judge Henderson's statement that she rang out in the Galveston County Daily News that, I did kick her out. She was only wearing a headscarf. It wasn't a religious wear. that it then it reminded the trial court that you have to be a little bit more sensitive because we exist in a pluralistic society.
So she got a greater relief that, from the, that standpoint than when she originally filed the suit, because she just wanted to go into this one courtroom and wear her relief, wear her headgear. But as a result of this letter, all the courts in the second administrative district are reminded that she has a right to do
absolutely
that.
And as an example in terms of our society being pluralistic, if for example the judge sits on the bench and it's Good Friday and someone walks in the courtroom with the ashes on their head and the court said, "Wash your face. How dare you come in my courtroom like that?" I will submit to this court that how we view constitutional rights, we view them contextually, we view them in not in a void, in sterile language, we view them contextually as what happens in the real world. And that if that person simply said, "All I want the court to recognize that we are of different faiths, I didn't disturb the courtroom, and I can't," and what happens is, and I agree with Judge Benavidez, she has a greater right that she won't get kicked out and won't occur again, because courts in the circuit have now been reminded about the virtue of the First Amendment.
Well, we're talking about two different things, it seems to me. One is the standard. I mean, first let me say I think you and your client have handled this, and you know, just from my view, speaking for myself, in an admirable way. You have taken the task and not tried to go beyond what you have just said and got the relief that satisfied you. But now we're dealing with the issue of whether you're entitled to fees for the way that you did this. And when I said actual relief, and Judge Benavidez saying everybody has been reminded, not just the one judge, but a reminder is of what rights already exist. An enforceable judgment is creating something that itself becomes the mechanism by which rights are enforced in the future. And how did you get that from this process?
Just Suffolk, what you ignore is fait accompli. The act had already occurred. The letter was done. The only way this matter got resolved is that they had to engage in offer, acceptance, agreement.
But it's the change is what's bothering me, not so much what you're saying, Mr. Griffin. If, going back to another suggestion earlier, if this letter had said or been based on the premise, a lot of you out there have not been following this, this judge is ignoring the rules, change your policy and henceforth no longer require people to do A, B, and C. That would have been actual relief. Enforceable or not is a different issue, but it would have been actual relief altering defendant's behavior. And instead, this is reminder without any finding that anybody's behavior fell short of this.
And or that there was a policy.
And I think that even if, and if I can, because I can do this.
You do maybe have two questions, however you want to do it.
The reminder is associated with trying to resolve the case in its most simplistic manner. It was part of the contract. Just simply remind the judges of the Constitution. The other reminder is that this case wasn't tried in a vacuum. Yes, the Galveston paper did report, and the other papers did report, because it's incumbent upon the press that they want the First Amendment supported also. And they take a position that if this occurred, we need to report on it because it's important for everyone. Policy. Judge Henderson is a state actor. And as a state actor, she engaged in an unconstitutional act, assuming our facts to be correct. And I'm not sure our facts necessarily would be in dispute because it was settled. As an unconstitutional, she took an unconstitutional act. And as I understand unconstitutional acts, if that police officer engaged in an unconstitutional act, it doesn't necessarily mean that the city gets off the hook if you have a police officer. Well, that may be a wrong or bad argument.
You don't want to go down that road in 1983.
We impose a greater burden on cities under Bunnell and police officers. But there are cases out there that talk about state actors taking actions and binding the state.
Well, but
and
you
even
did.
If there's not an official policy from the second administrative district, there clearly was a policy of this judge.
But you dismissed this judge, and that's why we went through the
hypothesis. I dismissed this judge at the behest of the state because the state said the proper person to sue would be Judge Underwood representing the district. He was simply brought in as a means to represent the district, and then the district court said, bring in the proper party, which was Judge Underwood.
Is that because he was the proper party initially, or because he became the proper party if he wanted to get something out to all the judges?
If he wanted to get something out to all the judges, and because of judicial immunity, what we're really saying was we're not suing for damages, we're suing for an acknowledgement, an injunctive relief, declaratory relief, that this, you can't do this. And so there's no damages against this state actor. Judge Underwood is simply the conduit by which you bring the second, the proper.
It's the way you enforce the settlement.
Absolutely. And the settlement was in full circle, just Southwest. The settlement actually was actual relief that had already took place. There was nothing left for us to do. There wasn't anything to enforce or any consent decree.
I mean, you could have gotten an injunction if you had taken this case all the way to its end, an injunction against Judge Henderson, the Second Amendment region, the entire state of Texas's judiciary, that you are not to bar people from your courtroom who are wearing religious head coverings. That was not obtained. And so, I mean, this gets back to this issue of the enforceability and whether something enforceable came out of this.
But then I get accused of prolonging the litigation and beating people over the side of the head and versus trying to resolve it as simple as possible. I took the admonishment of the trial court. The trial court said, wait, stop. And he had said it not once. He had said it in other proceedings. Wait, stop. What are y'all doing? Get this resolved as simple as possible, as less pain for the state as well as the plaintiff. What can we do? And I thought about that. And so when the question finally got asked again in a subsequent hearing, and I talked to my client. The record shows, that's out of the record, I apologize to the court, but that in the resolution of this issue, the most simplistic manner of resolving the case took place. And when Justice Rehnquist was right, we've changed the law, it's not a catalyst anymore, but when Justice Rehnquist says that when the trial court incorporates the agreement in the order of dismissal, then it's sufficient. And so what we did to resolve it in the most simplistic manner is consistent with the law, and my client was the prevailing party. There has been no challenge whether the fees
are. What you're saying is you had an admission by the actor first complained of that he did this.
Yes.
He had an admission that he did it, and after you had an admission that he did that, the court urged you to work something out. The state says, well, wait a minute, the proper party is this person.
Absolutely.
And regardless of whether that's a proper party or not, that was how you effectuated this settlement. So that, but for that admission that this happened by the actor, you would never got to the settlement.
That's correct.
And I mean, I don't know whether you're going to prevail in the light of, you know, some of the prevailing party language that's used, that relying completely on Judge Rehnquist's comments. But it just seems to me that you got what your client wanted. And you did it in an efficient way that saved the state a whole lot of money.
And
disposed of this case in a very efficient way to help everybody. And but for your efforts, this suit would probably still be pending. So I don't know how you know, maybe you don't come under prevailing party, but there's some great equities on your side.
And one last point, Your Honor. One of the things the trial court did In our submission of attorney's fees, he even cut back the attorney's fees. So it wasn't even an issue of I'm giving the plaintiff all the plaintiff asked for. We requested $350 an hour. He cut it back to $250. And then, so the whole concept of reasonable attorney's fees, there's been no challenge on that. And then the last point. The second point is materially alter the legal relationships of the parties. The parties' relationship was materially altered. And it was altered to this degree that my client, Mrs. Board, could walk into a courtroom in Galveston, Texas, Conroe, Texas, and anywhere in the second administrative district on a child support case. And the judges have been reminded that she has a constitutional right to wear religious headwear. And that is as simplistic as this case was, and we tried to keep it simple, and we contend that we were the prevailing parties, and we asked the court to affirm the trial court's judgment. Thank you.
Counsel, I have a question about the facts based on that last exchange. I understand the issue about the Galveston paper quoting Judge Henderson and so forth, but did, during the course of the litigation, was there an admission by Judge Henderson that she, A, had a policy of refusing to let people wear religious head covering, and B, in fact, enforced that policy against Ms. Boyd?
No, and the record does not support that assertion. I think that very much needs to be cleared up right now. The record does not support the counsel's statement that the plaintiff was ever asked to leave the courtroom based on her religious headwear, or that the judge said anything or admitted that she excluded her from the courtroom based on her religious headwear. Again, the judge did not kick this woman based out on her headwear. Since we've gotten into the facts, we might as well add to that a little bit. The judge asked the woman to leave the courtroom to meet with an attorney in the hallway. These are child support cases. Everyone is asked to leave the courtroom to meet in the hallway with an attorney. If the attorney doesn't resolve the issue, then they come back into the courtroom and they handle it in front of the judge. The way the complaint reads, the way Mr. Griffin talks about it today, you would think that it sounds as though she was sent out in the hallway because of her headwear, and that's really not the case at all.
But there's no transcript, I take it, of this. There wasn't a court reporter going. Yeah.
Exactly. In this case, there was no findings of fact or conclusions of law.
There wasn't a trial.
Exactly. Under Buckhannon, the term prevailing party does not authorize courts to award attorney's fees where the plaintiff's claim lends some support or is colorable or is not completely frivolous. I mean, the mere fact that his complaint may have survived a motion to dismiss is not good enough. It's just not good enough. Boiled down to its most simple form, under Buckhannon, which is the authority on this, under Section 1988, and we get distracted on some extraneous details regarding the case, but is there a judgment in this case? To qualify for attorney's fees, is there a judgment in this case? No. Is there a court-ordered consent decree in this case? No. Is there a settlement in this case? Well, there's a letter that doesn't really follow any sort of conventional form of a settlement agreement and doesn't define the rights of the parties and doesn't provide for attorney's fees. But in the Fifth Circuit, this circuit has never even ruled on whether or not a settlement agreement is even ever good enough. I don't think we need to rule on it here today, because I think even if you follow some of the other sister circuits who have liberally construed Buckhannon to provide for attorney's fees in cases where the settlement agreement involves such a high degree of judicial approval and oversight and changed and modified the legal relationship of the parties, it just does not chin the bar under any standard that we have, that we can look to for guidance.
What about the equities that Judge Benavidez spoke of? I mean, we do have, I do think Mr. Griffin's handled the case very compassionately for his client in an effort to work things out with the state. So what do we do? I mean, if we have people coming in courtrooms that are being refused, and those are the disputed facts, I understand, but that is her position, that she was told to leave because she was wearing religious headgear. Is there no remedy for that?
Mr. Griffin could have sought a consent
decree. And so is he required to perpetuate litigation and further incur fees that may or may not get compensated in order to get there? I guess that's really the essence of the prior exchange.
Yeah, I think you're going to win on this, but what you're doing is you're going to be forcing plaintiffs in these cases not to enter into agreements with you and to litigate these matters more. And so, you know, what you get in one hand, you give back in the other.
Okay.
I guess that's the way it works out.
Well, I think there's an element of negotiation here. I mean, I think, again, he could have sought a court-ordered consent decree in this if to seek the attorney's fees in this case. In a case in which there was no findings of fact, no conclusions of law, and merely a statement at docket call that the parties should seek about a resolution in the case. But again, I'm repeating what you already know. So thank you.
We have your argument. Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Mr. Griffin? Oh, I guess Mr. Redfield.
I think we're done.
We're done.
Thank you both.
Both of them.
He just enjoyed your argument so much they wanted to hear from both of you.
I'm not used to finishing this early.